sorry, we're going to have a little bit of noise from the coffee making, but we are terribly grateful for coffee, so we will not complain. Welcome to TJS this morning. We have, yet again, Duncan Rayburn.
thank you.
That's a lovely way of putting it, how the tools affect the tool makers, how communication technologies shape belief. This should hopefully change your perspective on a few things. So there is a commonly held belief that media are neutral, that media and technologies are actually not good or bad, but rather it's the messages that they convey that are good and bad. We accept this, but it's utterly wrong. My contention is that before something has said something, it has said something. These are both Audis, but they communicate completely different things. It's the same word, but it communicates different things. This room communicates something. It says something to us. It's haphazard, it's kind of casual. As soon as you see pews, the whole vibe changes. It becomes more serious. So before something has said something, it has said something. Jaron Lanier said this: context has always been a part of expression because expression becomes meaningless if the context is arbitrary. Meaning is only meaning in context. Or, as Marshall McLuhan says, the medium is the message. The medium is actually already a message. Something coming out of the mouth of Paris Hilton sounds different to something coming out of the mouth of a philosopher like Slavoj Žižek. So, who no one here has read, but he's really fun. Okay, not no one. So media or communication technologies essentially change the patterns of our thinking. Our thoughts are affected by the media or the technologies that we use. The way that you think about drinking coffee changes when you have a bigger mug or a smaller mug, as in mine. The way that you sit down changes, or the way you think about sitting down changes because of the chair you're on. Hopefully by the end of this you'll start to look at the world a little bit differently. It's quite a profound idea. Shane Hipps says this: we become what we behold. Our thinking patterns mirror the things we used to think with. So what I want to do now is actually just play you a very short, well, it's actually not that short, it's an advert, obviously international because it's a bit longer, and this emphasizes this idea. So here we go.
In the beginning was a screen. Millions of us came together in a public place to understand the present, to see visions of the future, sharing emotions, sharing experiences that shaped our lives.
I have a screen.
Then there was a second screen. It connected us to our world, and even to other worlds. It gave us amazing new games to play. It made us think and got us talking. But although this is a world we could all share, the experience itself was becoming private. Then came a third screen. It changed the way we worked and played. It became part of something much bigger, the internet. And a revolution happened. We could play new games in new ways, find new music in new places. New communities, new kinds of communities emerged. But the experience had become individual, even solitary. The sense of community felt real, but it was virtual. And then everything changed. It changed forever. Everything came to us in a device that fit into our pocket. We went back out into the world. We listened to what we loved, where we liked. We played when we wanted, where we chose. We shared what inspired us with everyone we cared about. We carried our sense of purpose with us. We discovered new people, places and experiences. And our sense of purpose had grown. It was the end of something. who is the beginning of everything. Welcome to the fourth screen.
Our sense of purpose kept growing. Because of a cell phone, apparently. It was the beginning of everything. It's kind of... A few assumptions are being made. One of them is good. The one is that media affect the way that we think. The one that is wrong is that when a new technology comes along, the others disappear. The others are changed, or the way that they are used may change, but they're still very much present with us. So, and of course, this reminds me of Plato, who said... because he had a cell phone. He said this now. He's telling the story. Now, the king of Egypt at the time was a god, Thamus. To him came Thuth. Don't get Thamus and Thuth confused, because you got Thamus and Thuth. Very difficult to say. To him came Thuth to show his invention, saying what ought to be imparted to other Egyptians. When it came to writing, Thuth declared, I have discovered a sure receipt for memory and wisdom. To this, Thamus replied, you have attributed to it quite the opposite of its real function. Those who acquire it will cease to exercise memory and become forgetful. What you have discovered is a receipt for recollection, not memory. As for wisdom, your pupils will have the reputation for it without the reality. They will receive a quantity of information without proper instruction. And because they are filled with the conceit of wisdom instead of real wisdom, they will be a burden to society. This is ingenious. You suddenly realize why Plato is so significant. So he's got these two characters, the god Thamus and the inventor Thuth. And Thamus is right. He says that writing erodes memory. This is true. When you want to remember things, especially now with information overload, you write it down somewhere so that you won't forget. But you, in writing it down, forget. So that you can look at it later. Oh, I had to remember that. Okay, now I remember. But writing doesn't transmit wisdom. It may convey, as Thuth says, writing does transmit knowledge. So he's right as well. Thuth also says it has the potential to expand consciousness. Both of them are right. The technology itself does change the pattern of the mind. But they're also both wrong. They're what you can call one-eyed prophets. They both have the other eye closed, so they're not seeing stereoscopically. Neil Postman says this in Technopoly. Our culture is filled with throngs of zealous Thuths, one-eyed prophets, who see only what technologies can do and are incapable of imagining what they will undo. This is something that I want to point out. So I tend to focus a little bit more on the negative side of technology just because it's this side that we tend to forget. So the idea here is that media or communication media give and they take away. Because a medium is any extension of ourselves. A hammer is an extension of the arm. Our cell phone is an extension of the ear and the mouth. And in some way, our presence. We are extended into space because of the internet. So we need to understand how media work to know how they give and how they take away. What's helpful to think about is the myth of Narcissus and then the myth of Perseus fighting Medusa. Narcissus sees himself in a reflection, in a mirror, and falls in love with himself. And Perseus sees that the mirror is useful for defeating the Gorgon, Medusa. So same thing, mirror, but the medium is used or understood in a different way. And Shane Hipps writes this in his book Flickering Pixels. A lot of this I owe to him. The chief error of Narcissus was not that he fell in love with himself, but rather that he failed to recognize himself in the water's reflection. Narcissus, derived from the Greek word narcosis, which means numbness, became enslaved to his own image. When we fail to perceive that the things we create are extensions of ourselves, the created things take on godlike characteristics, and we become their servants. Which reminds me a lot of Fight Club. The stuff you own ends up owning you. The reason that happens is because you don't recognize it as stuff. Okay. The mirror in the myth of Perseus, of course, is different. Perseus recognizes the use of the technology or the medium of the mirror, and this is exactly the thing that gives him power. So what I'm going to do here is three things, really. One, to examine two forms of communication and their effect on faith. I call the first set of technologies logopaic technologies, logos and poema, making knowledge or working towards the analytical side of our heads. I made that word up because I thought I could. And then there are mythopaic or intuitive technologies like images. Storytelling comes out of this. Second thing I want to do is to run through a few major cultural shifts caused by technologies, and far too briefly, of course, but these are things you can think about. And then thirdly, I want to describe in very general terms how communication technologies shape faith in our culture today. So the first technology we can look at, this is a logopaic technology, print. Remember, our thinking patterns mirror the things we used to think with. We become what we behold. The Chinese alphabet is an example of print, but it's not it's image based. Their writing is very pictorial. And so when their printing press came along, and this is 600 in the Common Era, this is a new technology that made no difference to them, because they didn't have an interchangeable alphabet. They had 80,000 characters, or that's what they have now. That's still growing. Can you imagine typesetting 80,000 characters? It's totally unhelpful. But when press comes into the Western world, it completely changes the entire thing, because the Western alphabet, thanks to the Greeks, is interchangeable. You can shift things around and you can create new words out of the same basic set. So the effect of the printing press is, in the first place, the Reformation was made possible because of the printing press. So you can already see the link to faith here. It meant that people could get access to information, they could get educated about what the Bible actually says instead of relying too much on hearsay. There is a definite shift away from images. The images in the Catholic Church, you had Stations of the Cross, you would actually walk around and understand the story. But there's a shift to Pauline theology. I mentioned this last week, but it's really crucial, or an interesting idea to notice, is that Martin Luther said, the best of the Gospels by far is the book of John. And Paul's epistles and Peter's epistles are to be preferred above the first three Gospels. Why? Because the Gospel of John is loaded with ideas. The Word, the Logos, became flesh and dwelt among us. There's these concepts which are very abstract. Pauline theology is very abstract. And so there is a focus on laws, doctrines, abstractions. And there is definitely a change in church layout. So Shane Hipps writes this: the linear arrangement of pews in churches didn't exist before the printing press. The medieval church didn't have pews, just a wide open space for standing. After the printing press, church seating started to mirror the page of a book. So, we become what we behold. This should be somewhat alarming to you. The other thing that was made possible because of print was the Enlightenment. Okay, because reason became the primary source of legitimacy or authority. You could think through things, because writing is a linear progression. It works in what is called syllogistic logic. There's 1 + 2 = 3. That's syllogistic logic. You can mess with that, which is really fun. The focus in the Enlightenment is in science and technology, things you can reason through. And there's a focus on notions for the first time in history. This becomes a big issue: biblical inerrancy and absolute truth. That happens around here. 1700s, this starts to become an issue. So some of us are like obsessed with absolute truth, and it's not unimportant, and certainly biblical inerrancy is not unimportant, but the shift in focus is perhaps a little heavier than it should be. And then, of course, what happens is belief starts getting explained in purely rational terms. we do this all the time. I mean, we, this group here, because we want to think about our faith. This is important, but it comes out of this sort of linear progression in thinking. And then, of course, the Industrial Revolution is made possible by the printing press. That was kind of the printing press. Gutenberg's idea was actually a prototype for industry because it mass produces things. This results in the mechanization of society, and life becomes viewed largely in transactional terms. I'm not going to unpack that. That's way too big an idea. What happens then, because of this focus on the linear, is that there is a definite decline in mysticism. The mystics are largely in Catholicism. Still today, that it seems like that attracts people who are more sort of in tune with images and that kind of thing. There's a decline of intuition. There's a decline of a focus on emotion. Even today, I saw when I was brave enough to go into Qum, there was a book on understanding your emotions. Emotions are part of your faith too. And this is, for us, in this age, still being affected by the Enlightenment, this is a radical idea. But this is the result of our, well, cultural indoctrination. And of course, reading is a solitary act. So it encourages individualism. And this, of course, encourages the deadening of desire. If your faith becomes always a thinking faith, let's think through point A, point B, do these doctrines match up, it starts becoming kind of dull. And that is the danger. I don't know if you've ever experienced this. If you're going through a spiritual dry patch, sometimes the worst thing you can do is read Paul's letters. They don't necessarily excite you. The things that might lead you a little bit further along the way is to read stories. Maybe the Bible stories are better for that. Does this make sense to you? So, no. But that's okay. It doesn't have to. Anyway, so Shane Hipp says, regardless of what is being communicated, the printed words whisper subliminal messages. You're an individual. Remain objective. Think rationally. These are not bad things. But just notice how this gets emphasized. Then, of course, there's the shift from print to Morse code. The reign of print is kind of 400 years. We are still, actually, it's longer than that, but pure print on its own, got to rule the roost for about 400 years, and then came Morse code. And for the first time, meaning and context get divorced, because you can send messages long distance. There's the history of communication gets broken up. This is why it's called Victorian instant messaging. They didn't call it that. So information actually becomes a commodity. The value of information is no longer its meaning, but rather how fast it travels, how quickly it gets to you. So efficiency is king. Information then trumps wisdom. And the logic of books starts to disintegrate. In a book, you can explain context. You can explain why you have reasoned up to that one point. But in a Morse code message, tried like Plato in Morse code. We have the same problem now, of course. This is why this is so significant. We have Facebook feeds and Twitter feeds and a myriad other SMSs. How many times have you miscommunicated something in an SMS? Astonishing, because you try. How do you get body language across, and you have this whole line of reasoning? So usually I'm in the middle of typing an SMS and I think, this is crazy, I'm just going to phone this guy. Because it's a limited technology. It is a kind of technology. That's actually an important point. What happens is the essence gets extracted from a message, and that is often at the expense of the substance. This is why quoting scripture out of context is so dangerous. You can quote, the devil quotes scripture to Jesus. It's a good, like, just pull it out of context. You can take it to mean anything. I mean, let's take the psalm where it talks about, blessed is the man who dashes babies against the rocks. What? That's crazy, man. Unless you start to understand what, you know, there is a bigger context. As the telegraph wrapped the world in a web of wires, it began to whisper a new subliminal message. Truth itself must be a lot like information. The idea of truth becomes entirely idiosyncratic. History is irrelevant. There is no rational basis for valuing one thing over another. And so what happens is doubts in a single unifying narrative seep in. This is actually around 1840. This is where the conditions for postmodernism become possible. Everything starts to get split up. There's a focus on use or useful information. And as some theorists say, postmodernism is essentially the absolutization of praxis. Action becomes the most important thing because theory becomes inaccessible. It's just all, woo, we don't know. I'm sort of strawmanning postmodernism. It's actually kind of useful in other ways. Anything that is not overtly useful gets thrown away, but use is always measured from an Enlightenment standpoint. So it's useful in terms of science and technology and reason, but not useful in terms of emotional stability and personal growth and spiritual growth even. And of course, this makes information overload a real possibility. Morse code is responsible for Nietzsche. No, that's actually a bit of a stretch. But in some ways, the fact that information and truth starts to get fragmented allows a culture that is kind of disconnected from the world. And so suddenly there becomes this thing of, well, maybe God is dead. Nietzsche was born in the same year that Morse code was invented. Truth becomes a relative concern, which we are now familiar with. This is the birth of the existentialist philosophy. In other words, action, praxis, something you do, and how you act in the world. And if it's no longer personally useful, it's no longer true. It's no longer relevant, at least. So print has... What happened with the printing press is it moved people out of communities into isolation. But now, one step further from that, Morse code takes that isolation and it adds isolation from truth or from context. So it one step worse. Which reminds me of Plato again. I'm just going to re-quote this just so that you with how profound it is that he wrote this so long ago. As for wisdom, your pupils will have the reputation for it without the reality. They will receive a quantity of information without proper instruction. And because they are filled with the conceit of wisdom instead of real wisdom, they will be a burden to society. And then photography comes along. This makes also huge changes. Photography is actually really ancient. You can actually trace it back to the ancient Greeks, but in terms of printing on paper, it sort of dates around the 1820s. And it's democratized by George Eastman in 1884. With the invention of film. So you can take it home and take family photos, all very nicely posed. The history of this is fascinating because the initial response to photography was to look at how people portrayed other people or environments in paintings. And then to go, well, that's what art is, so we need to actually try and capture that in photos. Of course, it went horribly wrong when it came to nude photography. So photography becomes a very, very powerful persuasive force. And of course, if you heard Jim Paul's talk on consumerism, he spoke about Edward Bernays, who is he's called the father of public relations, and he is responsible for the beginning of consumerism. Essentially, he used images to persuade people. Because they're very powerful. I'll explain why. In the first place, the power of the image is that it actually hijacks your imagination. You no longer imagine what Gandalf is like if you're reading Lord of the Rings. You see Gandalf is Ian McKellen. It's the same. So you don't have to imagine anymore. And in fact, it becomes very difficult to imagine something once you have seen something. So Shane Hipps writes this: if a picture is worth 1,000 words, then images must communicate information far more efficiently than words. The truism contains another assumption, however, that one medium can function interchangeably with another. and this isn't true. So what images do, they are the kind of, I'm calling them mythopoeic technologies. Actually, before I go on, I want to point out that print has the ability to act as images, as I mentioned, Bible stories, that those conjure images, and there's a certain level of solidity to them, and pictures can conjure words. So I don't want to divorce these completely. But images make you feel rather than think. If I tell you, there's a sad person sitting over there, you will all have a different picture of that sad person. If I show you a sad person, you're no longer thinking about it, you're seeing it, and at that moment, you become more enveloped in it. Images focus on experience, what you understand from your own experience, or it focuses on empathy. It stimulates your brain, but kind of in the way that sugar stimulates your body. It's not necessarily always a good thing. And it bypasses reason, and as I said, it erodes imagination. Then with images, truth is primarily understood in terms of experiences, stories, and emotions instead of logic and reason. Truth becomes a lived thing. So this is why images actually focus on what in terms of faith, orthopraxis rather than orthodoxy. I'll explain how that is relevant to our culture in a minute. It accepts what is, because when you look at an image, you can't kind of play with the meaning very much. You can, I mean, you can a lot. I'm in visual culture, we do it all the time. But people might not buy it because there is something very solid in front of them. And then, of course, it draws people away from the inner world into the world of surface. Images, of course, are the one kind of technology that God is the most clear about warning us of. He says this in Exodus 20, verse 14. "You shall not make for yourself a graven or carved image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth below, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them and serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God." There are so many things you can try and unpack from what is said, but I'm going to say that the danger of images, well, there are three really big dangers. The first one is that images solidify what is fluid. When you take a photo of a person, you can get, those great shots where the eyes are just sort of like halfway, and that none of us experience reality in that way. So it creates the illusion of reality in a sense. Images it actually just removes you one step away from the real. Okay, so it solidifies what is a fluid thing. Life is energy. Speak to quantum physicists, or physicists for that matter, that's true. It also deadens that which is alive. An image is a dead thing. It's stuck because it's solid. And then, of course, it takes what is deep and it makes it shallow. Images have a lot of really powerful, good qualities, but these are the dangers. And this is idolatry in three easy steps. So what's going on? There are two types of technologies, the logopaic and the mythopaic, and what I would say is that when these become disconnected or confused, the result is usually an imbalance in faith or a loss of faith. Faith becomes kind of too reliant on one and not enough on the other, and life becomes split up. So I'm going to run through kind of the major shifts in culture. I wish that I could go into a lot of depth here, but these are just the major shifts. In the first place, there was a shift from oral to print culture. And this means there is a movement away from relational connection. People live in community. You know everyone's name. You know what's going on in everyone's lives. That sort of community, wisdom and knowledge is transferred through speaking, oral culture. But then to print, you become isolated. The second shift is from print to bit culture. I call it bit culture. It adds a disconnection from depth to the already existing relational disconnection. And then from bit to print culture, from bit and print culture to image culture. This adds experiential depth, often vicarious, because now you can actually live your own life through other people's lives. You don't have to experience something yourself. You just watch a movie because there are, in fact, the experiences in the movie sound, well, seem a lot more enthralling than our own. There's a book by Neil Gabler called Life the Movie, How Entertainment Conquered the Western Mind. I really would recommend it. He talks about how, because of films, we now think of our lives in terms of movies. We want to take photographs that show off some sense of, wow, this was an adventure, or take movies, videoing weddings, for example. That's one thing that's very, as Linda and I are planning for our wedding, we're not doing that. Because in a way, like, we want to remember it as we experience it, not through someone else's lens. I think it's, and not that we're going to remember it, I suppose. Anyway. but again, so anyway, this vicarious experiential depth is added, but there is in this a deficiency of intellectual and relational depth. So there is a lack of wisdom. Then, another shift from image culture to radio and TV. And now, obviously, this is just building. It's not that images disappear or that print disappears. We're still very much affected by these. But what happens here is what develops is a kind of collective mind, but at a distance. Everyone watches the same TV program. So you can discuss it afterwards with your friends, but you're watching it at the same time. But you aren't with anyone, really. That's exactly, that advert really shows that. You move away from the cinema in a collective to an individual private home experience. And then, where we are now, from TV and radio culture to social media culture. Again, it just exacerbates an existing problem. It's the collective mind at a distance. Our consciousness becomes fragmented, and our experience of reality becomes largely virtual. When you read a Facebook feed, you see millions of comments, and I mean, I was shocked the other day to read that one of my friends has just had a baby. So my immediate response was, she was pregnant. There's such a disconnection, and you do start to wonder, what is the point of this? Are these really friends? I mean, to some extent, this writer Jaron Lanier says that Facebook demeans the concept of friend. It takes this thing which is an intimate personal communication or relationship and turns it into something that's very distant. To some extent, though, I would take that further and say maybe cell phones do the same. You don't need to visit someone, just phone them. Much easier. Much more expensive, but much easier. So everything is split and fragmented even more. Jaron Lanier says this, anonymous blog comments, vapid video pranks, and lightweight mashups seem trivial and harmless. But as a whole, this widespread practice of fragmentary impersonal communication has demeaned personal communication. So I have a few questions. Maybe we can bash these out a little bit as when we get into discussion time. I don't have a lot of answers here. I wish I did, but yeah, maybe we can figure this out together. How does discipleship work in a culture of relational disconnection? How is truth perceived in a culture of disintegration? I've written about this in my academic work. I call the interpretive practice that we operate by a hermeneutics of disintegration, an interpretive practice of disintegration, where you make the assumption right off the bat that everything is fairly nonsensical and disconnected. The corollary of that is that maybe we can strive for a hermeneutics of redemption, a kind of a practice of striving to create and understand an integrated reality. Then, how can room be made for authentic faith? And this would be faith that is deep, lived, real, experienced, thought about, passionate, compassionate, global, local, driven by the desire to heal relationships, instead of to perpetuate this kind of cultural and relational disconnection. In other words, a belief that is not just reliant on defaults of acceptance or apathy or ignorance. I think these are the defaults, defaults of our culture. If you get overloaded with information, what do? Opt out. If you get overloaded with bad news, we don't have enough of that, but anyway, opt out. Just apathy or ignorance. I don't want to know about it because it's just too much. I do want to point out, this is just fascinating. In the Middle Ages, you would know 100 people max. That's it. And that was your community, and you would have to get along with them. Now we know millions of people, so it's easy. If you don't get along with someone, you just leave and go to another community. If your church is making you unhappy, you go church hopping. You don't try and change it. It's really, this is a new thing. So you don't actually need to develop any proper relationships because this is the culture that we live in and we seem fine with it. Maybe, as a suggestion for getting back to authentic belief, we can return to the idea that what you believe is important. People who say that it doesn't matter what you believe, I actually was chatting to a student the other day who said this, he doesn't care what people believe. You do. You care if someone believes that we should kill people and then go, that person just happens to be in the same room as you. So we do actually care. We should be very careful about those sort of extreme statements, of course. And maybe we can return to the idea that there is, in fact, a reality behind all of this mediation, all of these flickering pixels. And then how can we be human in the face of increasing domination of technology? That's a good question to ask, because technologies can dehumanize us to a certain extent. So, 5 closing ideas, and then we can chat about these things. In the first place, I would say that faith is always going to be understood as a communication event. It is a communication event. God steps into history, speaks to people, and then gives people responsibility to take what he has said and do something good with it. So we need to understand communication technologies, because if we don't understand these communication technologies, we will not actually understand our own faith. That is the consequence of that ignorance. And the second thing is, ours is a culture of relational and epistemological disconnection. When faith is communicated, then, it needs to be communicated in a way that, one, doesn't alienate those who are part of this culture. Two, is primarily shown to be existentially relevant. And three, invites, opens doors, extends hospitality and warmth. Being argumentative in our culture just doesn't work. You will never argue anyone into heaven. Bearing in mind what I said last week, you will never. It's still true. If, in fact, Ravi Zacharias said this brilliant thing. If you argue someone into believing God in God, you can argue them straight out of it. Because you've, confused knowledge and faith right there. Third thing is that ours is a culture dominated by mythopoeic technologies. This has only increased. So we've moved into storytelling technologies, myth-making technologies. And that's why the language of following Jesus to many people, especially of my generation and younger, it's much more comfortable to say I follow Jesus than I believe in Jesus. Because belief is abstract and distant and rational. That's how it is understood, at least in our culture. I'm not saying that that's exactly what it is. People would rather participate than just observe. And this is why there is, in many ways, this is why there's a return to the social gospel. And I know that there are problems when you divorce, again, orthodoxy from orthopraxis, but it's quite amazing that people are getting so involved in environmental awareness. Why is this happening now instead of 30 years ago when people... Well, actually, no, it was 40 years, 50 years ago when people started noticing, wow, we're messing up the planet. Only now are people going, whoa, we really need to do something. But this is directly affected by the technologies that are present in our world today. Then faith needs to be communicated in terms of artistic expressions first. You invite people into a world of art. This is one of the biggest, I've said this millions of times, one of the biggest problems with Christian art, well, the Christian world, is that the art isn't very good. So now, how do you take bad art to the world and say, what we live and what we breathe is actually meaningful. You can't do it. It doesn't work. Unless people like bad art, in which case it's great. Well done. There is a return to an oral culture in a way. And this is quite interesting for me. In a way, our postmodernism is closer to the culture of Jesus' time than at any other point in recent history. So this is the good side of postmodernism. It forces people to actually talk on a daily basis. Even if it is virtual, there is a kind of connection. There is a kind of awareness of this community. Then ours is an age or culture of existential longing. That needs to be taken very seriously. I was reading one theologian who absolutely dismisses existential philosophy. And I just think that if he's quite old, so it maybe there's again a generational gap there, but I think if he doesn't take existential philosophy seriously or the existential longings of people seriously, he's going to reach no one from my generation. Not no one, but only he's not going to reach those who are interested in story and images and more sort of real life things. And then lastly, we need to remember Perseus. We need to notice, as Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 13, that we see in a mirror dimly. The Gorgon that we are trying to conquer is very real. We can't look at it. So we've got these media. And we need to figure out, well, this image is dim, but I need to notice that later on it'll be clear. Maybe. And that's where I end on that very odd note. And so, yeah, we've got time for questions and thoughts. Yes.
I've got a 15-year-old son who is, and I battle his computer games, what I call addiction. And also, when I notice when he's with his mates and they have sort of a mess gathering, half of them are sitting in a chair on their own, sort of doing their thing. They're not having fun together.
Yeah.
And but they're not having fun in terms of relating to other people. And what is a good strategy? Because he doesn't know what to do with himself, because we limit him not during the week and during the weekend so many hours. Out of the heat, he just doesn't know what to do with himself. He's completely lost.
What's the practice for him? What's a practice for you?
Yeah,
Plato.
Do you mean
Plato?
Plato or Socrates, yeah.
Plato.
Tanya, do you have a suggestion?
There was a program on recently on TV, of course I relate everything to this. BBC, Child of Our Time, it was called The Long Documentary. And in a Child of Our Time documentary, they talked about this little, like 10-year-old child who was playing 18 plus games and doing all this crazy stuff that his mother was pretty much neglecting him to do. But what was interesting was that out of the children of his age, he had the most linguistic ability and the most social skills. And the reason was because he didn't want to play alone. So what would happen was that what they did was they put an adult that he didn't know into a room with him and to play the game. And the adult didn't have a clue how to play the game. This child persisted way more, and the actual program itself, the actual episode itself, was about persistence and the value of persistence in the modern culture. And this child persisted way beyond belief, trying to get that adult to play with him. And so he had learned social skills that children of his age simply didn't.
I need to learn computer games.
I think that
the
principle is generally, especially if you're not used to it. Look, I have to be honest. I have friends who they're crazy about LANing. Anyone know LANing? You go like on a weekend. You go and you plug all your computers in together and you play some kind of a game together. You don't talk to anyone, and you're with your friends the entire time, and you spend the whole weekend, and you don't sleep. Red Bulls and all sorts of ridiculous energy drinks, and your pancreas explodes, and half the world dies from this. But anyway, This is kind of, whoa, that's, for me, I mean, that's my, that those are guys my age, and I struggle with that. But the first thing that we should realize is it's other, but not wrong. I think there is a, it's very important when you're approaching people who use technologies differently to go, well, I actually need to understand how they see this, what they do, and then to work within that. Otherwise, it creates polemics all over the place.
Yeah, what I just wanted to say is, that is world, and that is context. And the best thing to do is immerse yourself in that, to learn his language, to learn what how he perceives what he's doing, and what that is meaning to him, just as Duncan said. And then, in that, engage with him. But if you come from outside, you will be unheard.
Yeah, that's...
totally unheard. You won't be able to relate to anything you said, because it doesn't understand anything you said. Maybe the best thing is a week.
And then
game.
Also from that...
So I just want to learn computer, but he thrashes me. I mean,
that's fine. That's actually one of the great ironies. The kids now are they are culturally fluent. They understand technologies. They are, in the world of technology, they are the adults. The adults are the kids. So, yeah.
I agree a little bit with you, but I also think there's another part to that, and I think it all comes down to this, is children to a large extent learns from example, from how we as a society either live relationally or not. And I find it a struggle myself, because I tend to be an individualist myself. I especially experience it in, I mean, my kids are still small, but in this stage of my life, I experience this being, this state of heart feeling. And on the other side, I really have got this need for people to be involved. My mom has got this philosophy that, and I think it grew from this, that when you have your baby, she'll come for a day or two, she'll cook food, she won't help with your baby, and then she leaves, and you have to go. And if you think about how it was, way back when, I think women were a lot more involved. They would help, they would cook, they would look after the mom, they would help the baby, they would teach the mom how to actually look after the baby. And I mean, having a baby is quite an overwhelming experience. And I had the one, which was a difficult baby, and then I had twins, which was extremely overwhelming. And then, so it's, and then everywhere I go, it's not just my mom, society as a whole, they tend to stand back. So you go to the shop, got three little ones who are running around like crazy, and you have to have control in this setting where these shops are designed to get you excited, to get you to want things, to get you to act in a certain way. So you take these cute kids that just take up all these cues, and it's just, and you've got this list of kids. And then you see people walk by and go, well, you've got a problem, you have to take the one to the toilet, the other one refuses to go along, and now you somehow, you know what, I think if we can move to a state where we interact relationally and say, you know what, ma'am, I see you've got a problem here. Can I help you? Can I take this one and we walk along? Or how can I? I think we tend to judge and stand back and say, that's your problem. And I think teenagers and kids pick up on these cues all around them as they grow up. So I think the tendency of children to sit beside each other and not interact has all got to do with how the system that we're up in, where we don't interact with each other in a
level. I just want to point out one of the things that's crucial. If you have a rational backing, as in your primary mode of engaging with the world is a rational one, you have filters to understand how supermarkets work. Although, you notice how people go into shops? It's all speed, and I know what I'm going to get, and then 5 seconds into it, it's kind of this last zombie kind of... So, it depends on how... But I think what we need to do is engage with those who are, maybe addicted to technologies in order to help them develop filters against those technologies. Because I think it's not helpful to arrive at 25 or 30 and go, or even whatever the age is, and go, wow, I all I did was play computer games. I don't understand anything else. And it's very experience driven. They develop computer games to foster addictions. That's how they develop computer games. It's a will keep them addicted for the longest.
And reading a book is more satisfying, but it's more, it's not as exciting, and it's more effort, and so he doesn't get into that because it's just there's a computer game, instant excitement.
Yes, yes.
It can be a form of escapism. Yeah, it can be. I mean, years ago, I'm sure when novels just became popular, I'm sure a lot of parents were worried about their children being alone in the room and not interacting with their friends. I think we need to be in community, and in whichever technological era we find ourselves in, we will try and find some way to
One other thing, can I use an example from one of the best forms of teaching is this one where I can present you with a few ideas that I've been grappling with and where we can talk afterwards. One of the ways that I think sermons need to change in churches is precisely in this way. A while back, actually last year towards the end of the year, two friends and me sat on the platform at church. And we had a discussion sermon, which lasted nearly, it was about an hour and a half, right? So in the world of sermons, that is like a no-no. Like, people would be so upset if you do this. But it was largely to young guys. We had this discussion, but while the discussion was going on, people were SMSing questions. And then right at the end, we had question time. And it's amazing. One of the guys, he's like 14, he came to my friend Brian and he said, that was amazing. And he literally recalled everything. So all we did was overload them with information. And for the first time, it was engaging. Because it wasn't one person's perspective. And we had disagreements and jokes. And you know, the fluid things that happen with conversation. This idea of someone standing in front, it doesn't work, I know, because I'm a lecturer. If you just stand in front of people and go, this is the law, and then leave, they are not impressed.
So you're just in any church that exists something.
Yes. You had a...
It's not satisfying. This reminds me of, I don't know if you watched the movie Wall-E, the robots.
Yes.
Wall-E.
One of the things that's such a great suggestion, one of the things that really changed my perspective on how people raise kids is I stayed with a family in America that were raising their kids as a Mennonite family. In other words, like Amish people, but they kind of still live in, and they're allowed bright colors and odd clothes. My word. Yeah. Anyway, and breakfast cake as well. That was part of it. But in this family setup, there was no TV, no radio, no cell phones. It's technologically, so techno-Ludditism. And you'd think, oh my word, okay, firstly, these kids are going to be odd. Fact. They are, but odd in a way that they will know how to interact with people. They will know how to imagine. I've been teaching ideation at Tux for 5 years now. That's the process of coming up with concepts and ideas and generating. In the last 5 years, year by year, I notice a decrease in imaginative strength. The students can't imagine because everything is so oculocentric, image-based. That is a terribly dangerous thing. So I think it's good to... Oh, second point before I get to you, and we have a little bit of time. So, is that these kids are not completely excluded from technology. They will make a day to go and watch a movie at the cinema. And that's a big event. Suddenly, the sort of flatness of the world becomes interesting. Like, oh, there's a movie. This is great. So I think there should be a kind of a balance in that way. Colhan.
Isn't this type of disengagement as a direct result of the information overload, that you're so overloaded that you have to become numb?
Yeah. I think that the two sort of... The numbness is a result of staying on the surface. For example, if you want to find something out, you just go and look at Wikipedia. You don't have to read all the books that are sourced on Wikipedia. You don't need an expert. You're just staying... So your knowledge is just on the surface. So I think, yes, it's totally part of information overload because then, you know... I have friends who literally have, like, will open 50 Wikipedia pages and then read through them. Like, by the end... I don't know if they know more or if they are wiser. In fact, I think they will know more, but wisdom is not necessarily fostered in that sort of shallow environment. I don't know what to do about information overload because I tend to opt out as well. I tend to get into very big books with long words. Yeah. Small print, anyway.
One thing I am aware of is, I mean, you're presenting it simply for us, but I've heard talks about, for instance, the Enlightenment, that how parallel to the Enlightenment, there is always the second stream. So while you get the rationality, you also get the romanticism. They're always,
yes, you do. Yes.
There are parallel streams in our culture, in anyone's culture, because there are people who will, by nature, rebel against the rationality. And that's why you have the Brontes and the, you know,
yeah,
those kind of books and those kind of... I mean, what was it? So these two are always there, and I wonder if those who stick heavily on the rationality should fast in the in other words take time out from that world and live in the other world for a while, immerse themselves in the other world for a while. As if you were fasting, like fasting from food to recall why food is so important, or fasting from alcohol to remember that, okay, I'm not addicted to this stuff, or whatever,
yeah,
or the going off technology for a weekend or a month or whatever, just so that,
yeah,
you experience a difference. You know,
yeah,
being in community, okay, then being out of community. Okay, if you always spend a lot of time out of community, then go into community. It's kind of like step on the other foot.
Yeah. I think that is a spiritual practice to actually help you to understand technologies. That's very helpful. One of the things I do want to mention, though, is often when there's that dichotomy that happens, say, enlightenment, irrationality, what happens is emotions get treated as rationally as facts. So the emotionality of, I mean, if you want to hear intellectuals talk about romanticism, it's astonishing. It's just kind of like Helen and Sechel Mozart's talk about humor. The fact that you can rationalize something that feels so good. So it's very odd that... So maybe the thing is not to necessarily... Okay, I totally agree with your idea of fasting it. In fact, a friend of mine gave up social media for Lent and then just stopped after it. One year I gave up coffee for Lent, and for that whole year I didn't drink coffee. It was fantastic. It changed the way that I... And then when I had my first cup of coffee after that, yeah. Oh, yeah. I still haven't had the strength to give up tea. That's it. But yeah, it does. It changes the way you see the world, and I think that's pretty helpful. Okay.
And I'm afraid I think we have to stop. We'll have to fast from TJ for another week.
Yes.
But please come back next week. I have no idea what is next week, so you'll have to check the email.
That's
you
okay.
Didn't get
I have no idea.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Thank you.